wonderful, majestic world around us, it's time for Dear Science. Thanks to MOTAT, the museum inspiring the innovators of tomorrow.
So, how are we?
Very well, thank you, Casper. Yes, Christina's gone.
Yeah, Christina is gone. So it's just me for today. You'll have to make do.
I've just gone through so many wire hosts. You have no idea.
Yeah, I'm sure it's sad to see them all go. Yeah.
Oh, it is. Anyway, you know, onwards and upwards. So, yes. okay, so we're going to kick off today by saying that tomorrow is a big day.
Tomorrow is a big day,
which... Actually, I have heard nothing of, which really does rather surprise me, but it's Gregor Mendel's 200th birthday tomorrow.
Wow. Yes. And he looks good in all the pictures I saw for 200.
Indeed. Now, hopefully those folk of you out there listening might know who Gregor Mendel is. He was a Moravian monk, and he went into that field of things because it allowed him to get an education for free. But in addition to being a monk, he is known as the father of modern genetics. So if you didn't study this at school, here's a very, very quick sort of resume of what he did and why it was so important. So he started off studying philosophy and physics, as you do. He kept failing his exam to be a school teacher, which is seemingly what he wanted to be. So he went back to his abbey and decided to get into looking at plants, and specifically heredity. Goodness. So in other words, you know, why do plants have particular features? And what determines what gets passed on from generation to generation? And of course, we know this now as being genetics, but, you know, back in the day, nobody really had any idea of what was going on there. And they sort of thought that offspring would get sort of blended features from their parents, as it were. So that was sort of the theory at the time. So what he did, a very patient man, obviously, is he studied peas, a specific type of pea, and what he was looking at were in fact traits of peas, and seven specific traits. And these traits are, or were, I guess, so the shape of the pea, whether it was wrinkled or whether it was nice and smooth, the color of the pea, whether it was yellow or green, the color of the flower, whether it was purple or white, the pod shape of the pea, whether it was inflated or constricted, the position of the flower, either terminal at the end or axial along the middle of it, the height of the plant, tall or short, and the color of the pod, yellow or green. So seven traits that had to be either one thing or another. There was no sort of middle ground in any of them. And so what he'd do is he'd start off with pure breeding pea plants. And then, so in other words, you know, they would be peas that have the round peas with purple flowers, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And then he would crossbreed those with other purebred pea plants. And he basically would then see what would happen. And he'd follow this through generations. And he would study their progeny. And as a result of this, and again, you know, this is lots and lots and lots of very careful observations. So he did these experiments over around about 7 years, and it's estimated that he must have grown somewhere in the region of 28 to 30,000 pea plants.
That's a long time, a lot of peas.
He is a patient man, or was anyway. And what did he find? Okay, so he found that when you crossbred these peas and then looked at the first generation offspring, then those particular or particular facets came through and others didn't. Okay, and then when you look at the second generation, then you see these other facets coming through as well as the ones that came through in the first generation, which is very, very, very simplistic way of explaining things. But what he did was he basically coined the idea of traits being either dominant or recessive.
And I remember doing Punnett squares in high school. That's the same kind of thing, isn't it?
Yep, yeah. Absolutely. Okay. And so, for example, for these peas, so the round peas were dominant and the wrinkled ones were recessive. So when you crossbred them with something else, in the first generation, you would only see dominant, the round peas, and then in the subsequent generations, you would start seeing wrinkled ones as well. But the really, really, really important thing was that the ratio of these dominant to recessive in the second generation was always 3-1. And that got him thinking, and it got him thinking awfully difficult, awfully hard. And he then was able to rationalize that observation through a great piece of thinking, and basically said, right, each of the parents provides two parts, as it were, okay, to the overall, okay? And these two parts can be either dominant or recessive, okay? And if each parent is providing two of these parts, as it were, then there's four ways that you can arrange those, okay? So let's say one part is dominant-dominant, the other one's recessive-recessive. Then you can put those together as, in the four ways, dominant-dominant, dominant-recessive, recessive-dominant, and recessive-recessive. So in other words, there's only one way out of four that you can get the recessive combination occurring, whereas there's three ways out of four that you can get the dominant, because the dominant always predominates. And so therefore, that's what leads to this 3-1 ratio. And I mean, there's a whole lot more stuff that we're certainly not going to go into, but that's basically the guts of it. And this was a world-changing experiment, or it should have been, okay? So he published the paper on this in 1866 and was roundly ignored, in fact. Probably it didn't help that he was a monk. He wasn't sort of from a recognized scientific institution or anything like that. And in fact, the paper that he published was only cited three times in the next 35 years.
Wow. Despite being so rigorous and so many plants, so patient.
Yep, absolutely. And then in around about the year 1900, some other workers interested in heredity then rediscovered this paper and rediscovered the work of Mendel and went back through it and everything and thought, oh, hang on, you know, this could be important. And indeed it was. And basically what Mendel had discovered was the whole concept of genes, of inheritance through genes. Now, obviously, he didn't know what genes were in those days. And that would take another, probably about 80 or so years, sort of the 1930s, 1940s, to be figured out. And then you got the structure of DNA in the 1950s, and everything sort of goes from there in terms of modern-day genetics. But Mendel really was the beginner of all of this. And, you know, he absolutely deserves this name as the father of modern genetics. You know, the work he did was just so far ahead of its time and, you know, meticulously done beyond reproach, although in the 1930s, about 1936, some guy called Fisher looked at Mendel's statistics and said, nah, they're too good. And so the implication there being that somehow those numbers might have been fudged by Mendel or by an assistant or something like that. So there's been debate over the past, 90-odd years, I guess, since then, as to, you know, the veracity of Mendel's work. But, you know, without a doubt, he basically came up with the right answer.
And we still use similar methods today.
Yeah.
Do we use them just for peas, or do the same kinds of observations and the same kind of methods apply to other organisms?
Basically they do. But again, it's a lot more complicated than, you know, just what Mendel was looking at. So there are some organisms for which those rules don't necessarily apply, and now we know sort of the molecular basis of all of this and we know how it all works, then we can, I guess, rationalize those exceptions to Mendel's rules and stuff. But, 200th birthday tomorrow, I would have thought that would have been a big, 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 big deal. But, you know, as I say, I've really seen nothing of it in sort of the scientific literature or anything like that. So I think it's a day to be celebrated, really.
So he's still being not really given the credit he deserves.
Possibly. Well, I guess his name is certainly well known, but, you know, it's sort of these big anniversaries. They're normally, you know, I would have thought this would at least been the International Year of Genetics or something like that. They would have, you know, recognised it doing that. But, yeah. So, anyway, happy birthday, Gregor Mendel, for tomorrow.
Happy birthday, Mendel.
Okay, so the second story, this is a little bit of an arty story. There's not enough art in science, perhaps. So we're going to talk about that great composer that you've all heard of, Josquin des Prez. Yes, exactly.
My absolute favourite of all time.
Yes, I first came across Josquin des Prez when I studied first year music many, 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 many moons ago. And the lecturer was a big Josquin des Prez fan, and didn't really float my boat, if you will. But anyway, he was a Renaissance composer. He lived from around about 1450. Nobody knows when he was born. He died in 1521. And he was French, and he was big on polyphony, and that was his great contribution to music, was getting a whole lot of different voices going at the same time, essentially. Up until then, music had basically been sort of monodic, if you will, just sort of a single line, a single tune, whatever, but he got those voices going in harmony, etc., 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 and then you had J.S. Bach and the rest is history sort of thing. So he predated Bach and all of those great sort of Baroque composers. Now, the question comes as to the authenticity of his work, because there are 346 works supposedly attributed to him. There are no original manuscripts still in existence. And so therefore, basically we're going secondhand off sort of those current sources as to whether he did in fact write these things, because as I say, you know, no original manuscripts exist. Plus, this was right at the start of sort of the whole printing sort of thing, so a lot of his supposed works were printed after he had died. So the question then becomes, well, how do we know whether these works are in fact his or not, if we don't have any original manuscripts to go by? So this was a question that a musicologist at Stanford by the name of Jesse Rodin has been attempting to answer for quite some time now. Now, there's been enormous interest in Josquin's works, especially over the last century, and literally decades of work have gone into trying to determine the authenticity or not of these works. So Rodin has got together with some computer scientists, and basically what he has done is to start looking at whether you can basically figure out a composer's style by a computer, and from that figure out whether or how many of these 346 works are in fact his. So the way that they did this was that they had to start with works that were absolutely, definitely, undoubtedly attributable to Josquin. And of those, there are 54, which could be pretty definitely said to be his from basically from documents.
And that's just the core of a larger body.
Indeed, yeah. And so then what they did is to basically throw all the stuff in the computer. Don't ask me how, but I'm sure artificial intelligence is involved, I'm sure. And basically trying to figure out what Josquin's style is and which of those works are his. And so they've just published this. In fact, it was done last year, but sort of the results are coming out. And what they now say is around about 103, they think, of those 346 works are definitely Josquin's. And the rest are probably sort of hangers-on, people who imitated his style because he was really, really popular. He was the rock star of the day. And everybody wanted to sort of compose like him. So these stylistic features that define his work can basically now be quantified using computers, which I think is kind of cool. So,
and how novel is this, the idea of using such a kind of rigorous scientific method to kind of, like, in the realm of art history, to determine authorship? Because I know in the art world, it's perfectly acceptable to just say we don't know.
Well, funny you mention the art world, actually, because there's a lot of chemistry that goes on in the art world trying to determine provenance. And there was a great New Zealand scientist who was right at the forefront of all of that. And they would basically shine infrared light on pictures or on samples of paint from pictures, and they could figure out, you know, basically where that paint came from, how old it was, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So, you know, this is applying now a similar sort of thing, I guess, to now music and being probably able to, you know, essentially quantify music, which is basically what you're doing. And, you know, I think that's really rather cool.
And it's really cool to see kind of new technologies change the world of art, just as for this composer, the printing press allowed for him to be circulated and picked up by others and that.
Yeah, the printing press made a bit of a difference, didn't it?
Clearly some kind of an intersection there between science and art. We don't think about a lot.
Absolutely, yes. Yeah. So anyway, and on to our third story very, very quickly. Scanning tunneling microscopes. What do you know about those, Casper?
Very little.
Okay.
Lots. All kinds of things.
Okay, so chemistry is all about making molecules, okay? And in order to make molecules, what you have to do is essentially break bonds and make bonds. Make chemical bonds, break chemical bonds. And so some have likened this to basically throwing a whole lot of Lego into a tumble dryer or something and expecting some fully formed structure to just come out of it after a period of tumble drying, which is hopefully a little bit further away from the truth than we'd like to think. But so it's a difficult thing to do. But if we could manipulate molecules or individual molecules, we could then make those bonds and break those bonds within the individual molecules and make specified molecules that would otherwise be difficult, if not impossible, to make. So a team of researchers in Europe have now just reported their results on this very thing. And what they use is a thing called a scanning tunneling microscope. Okay. We all know that vinyl is back in vogue, okay? Much to my chagrin, I've got lots and lots of old vinyl, but the way that a, I'm going to sound old here, record player or turntable works.
This is BFM, I think you're in friendly hands.
So the way that works is you've got a very, very fine needle, and that is traversing a series of grooves on a piece of vinyl. And that's pretty much the way a scanning tunneling microscope works, except for the fact that the needle that you use is of atomic dimensions. It's really, really, really small. And basically what you're doing is you're dragging this needle just above the surface of a particular molecule or whatever you want, really. And there's a current that flows between the tip of the needle and the surface. And if you monitor the magnitude of that current as you're dragging the needle across the surface, then you can get basically a picture of the surface. That's pretty much it. So very, very similar to the way that records play. But what they've now found is that if you take that tip and you position it above a particular bond in a molecule and then put a voltage pulse through the tip, you can actually break that particular bond of the molecule. So they've got it to that particular level of precision, which, you know, we're talking about 10 to the minus 10 meters here, the length of a chemical bond, there or thereabouts. And you can basically place this tip with particular precision. You can whack a voltage pulse through there. It breaks that particular bond, and then the whole molecule then undergoes a chemical reaction to, I guess, overcome the loss of that bond. And so they've just reported the results of this in Science. And it's really quite remarkable. Certainly for us chemists, you know, I'm thinking, wow, this is amazing. People at home probably thinking, yeah, big deal.
Well, I think that the first question on everyone's mind is, obviously, can this be used for evil?
Well, considering that you can only make one molecule at a time, and that the apparatus required to do this is not exactly something that you're going to get down at your local Bunnings, no, I'd say it was probably a fair comment there. Yeah.
So, what does a new molecule mean? What can we do with that?
What can you do with it? You can understand it, I think, is the most important thing, because the molecules that they've made out of this stuff are very, very, very unusual molecules. Normally, they would just fall to bits as soon as they were made, but they're working at a temperature of 5 degrees above absolute zero, so everything's nice and cold. That stops things decomposing. And basically, it just allows you to understand more about the way that atoms get together and form molecules, and therefore how the world and how the universe works, because that's what the universe is all about. It's all about bonds between atoms. So the more we understand about that, the more we understand the universe. There you go.
Wow, that's fantastic.
That's my bog standard answer to that. So, yeah. So I think that will be it for today. So thank you all for listening, and thank you especially to MOTAT, who unflinchingly support all of this stuff. Thank you, guys.
And thank you so much for coming on and talking to us today, Alan.
Always a pleasure.
Really appreciate it.
I didn't know that before. Dear Science, thanks to MOTAT, the museum inspiring the innovators of tomorrow.